una máquina del tiempo, a time machine. Bradley K. Martin, an American journalist, made the same trip 1 year before and opens his book with a quote from The Time Machine by H.G. Wells. The shop, the advertisement, traffic, all that commerce which constitutes the body of our world, was gone. Christopher Hitchens, who, journalists being largely banned, also visited North Korea in the guise of a university lecturer, found it so extraterrestrial he called his piece Visit to a Small Planet. 1 dozen years on from the Hitch's galactic quest, it felt the same, that we had travelled back in time or across unknown dimensions to somewhere other than the known universe, and a place and a time spitting with hatred. An officer winding up a vast crowd of North Korean soldiers screamed on state TV, "We will destroy the United States mercilessly!" The reason North Korea is the most out-of-date-looking country on Earth, the one whose rulers reject the modern world so utterly, is no accident. Throughout its history, Korea, especially the North, dominated by its savage mountains, has turned its back on the outside world. It used to be known as the Hermit Kingdom. Long after China reluctantly accepted foreign treaty ports on the fringes of the Middle Kingdom, the Koreans held out, believing that the purity of the race must be defended at all costs. Invaders like plains. They don't like mountains and other geographical impediments to conquering, like islands. That means that long after the old believers on the plains had been wiped off the face of the earth, the religions, languages, and prejudices of the people up in the mountains linger. That's why Welsh, a language that by some yardsticks should have been at death's door from 1282 onwards, still sticks to the hilly bits to the left of England. Why Gaelic still survives in the islands off the far west of Ireland and the far north of Scotland. Ladino still prospers in the higher bits of the Dolomites 2,000 years after the Romans left. Why Chechen nationalism still pokes the Russian crocodile in the eye 1.5 centuries and more after Lermontov wrote his lullaby, which goes something like this. Tum-ti-tum, sleep, little baby, or the Chechen will come, tum-ti-tum, and cut your throat. North Korea is as wildly mountainous as Chechnya and as wildly hostile to any invading force. The soil is not fertile, and there are no great gold or silver mines such as made the conquistadors risk the climb into Peru. So for sensible reasons, the world left Korea well alone for centuries, almost as untravelled as the dark side of the moon. The founding myth of the Korean nation is as credible or silly as the one that they tell you about Rome. In Korea, a bear made love to a god, creating a deity called Tangun. The myth continues that Korea has been around for 5,000 years. The reality is that for big chunks of those 5 millennia, the difference between Korea and China was not vivid. For much of the country's long history, its northern border was fluid, and the national identities of literate Korean and Chinese mutually indistinguishable, writes Professor Brian Myers. In the year 936, the Goryeo dynasty was founded, and China and Korea became clearly separate. In 1392, the Joseon dynasty took power, bringing with them Confucianism, and a rigidly controlled set of 5 castes dividing society. At the bottom were the slaves or serfs, who continued to live miserable lives until the 20th century. Above them were the inferior people, butchers and grave diggers and the like. Above them were the peasant farmers, merchants and tradespeople. Above them, the translators, clerks and doctors, and above them, the ruling caste, the Yangban, or high officials of civic or military virtue, who enforced the Confucian mandate of heaven. Elitism and social stratification is hardwired into the Korean soul, and this truth remains so in both North and, to a lesser extent, in democratic South Korea to this day. Confucianism also demands ancestor worship and filial piety big time, a point made amusingly by Michael Breen when he recounts how in 2003 some bosses at Hyundai, South Korea's multi-billion dollar mega industrial complex, went to the company founder Chung Ju-yung to tell him in person that they had built the first road for tourists to travel into North Korea. At that point, Chung had been dead for 2 years. The Ancien Régime's social layer cakery resurfaced, if it had ever truly gone away, in North Korea in 1957 under Kim Il-sung, who introduced 51 layers, broadly dividing society into three: the core class, the wavering class, and the hostile class. The core class encompasses the regime's nabobs, ministers, secret policemen, senior army officers, and top members of the Korean Workers' Party and their families, the majority of people allowed to live in Pyongyang. Our minders would be core class, and as for foreign visitors, so temporarily would we. The waverers include other professionals, academics, potentially worthy citizens, tainted in some way by some anti-regime toxins. The third hostile class seems no different from the slaves of the Middle Ages, human cattle to be driven hard and left to die without compunction or compassion. The hostile class is held to be impure. Anyone who is tainted with foreign influences, ethnic Korean families in China or Japan, anyone with a Christian background, although this encompasses the Kim dynasty itself, or anyone with ancestral wealth or noble blood. Hostile class toxins can go back three generations, so perfectly brave soldiers or brilliant athletes can suddenly lose all privileges when a grandfather who spent time in Japan or ended up a prisoner for a time in South Korea is discovered in a background check. Family names brand an individual's identity. In the British census for 1881, one researcher counted 400,000 separate surnames. In South Korea, more than half the population of around 50 million share five names: Kim, Lee, Park, Choi, and Chong. The same is true for the North, too. The reason for Korea's poverty of names is because it was only in the 19th century that freed serfs had to find a surname. Very often they picked the name of a local ruling family. This must surely have an impact on the relationship between the mass and the individual, the caste and the single unit. There is also a crazy geographical element to the caste system, which sees hostile citizens shipped to the northeast of the country, close to the Chinese border. Time and again you will read about something dreadful happening in North and South Hamgyong provinces. This is where the famine of the 1990s hit hardest, and where the regime made it hardest of all for outsiders, that is, foreigners, to monitor whether food aid was going to the people who needed it the most. This is where the most revolts and rebellions against the Kim dynasty happen, all thus far crushed. One needs to look at the map of North Korea with the regime's deadly serious mindset of racial purity in mind. Pyongyang, to the southwest of North Korea, though of course in the waist of the whole Korean peninsula, is the bullseye of the core class, with cities like Changjin in North Hamgyong being on the outer limits of civilization. Much of the double tragedy of the late 1990s, when immense amounts of American and South Korean food aid ended up in the hands of the regime's haves, while the have-nots perished in their millions, was because of the foolish assumption that the government of North Korea wanted to keep all of its citizens alive. On the contrary, diminishing the power and numbers of the hostile class continues to be a real but unarticulated regime goal. Most of the inhabitants of the Gulag come from the hostile class, as do many defectors. The risks of getting out seem not so bad if you are at the bottom of the heap. That means that few defectors come from the core class or have ever visited Pyongyang, The ones who do are vivid exceptions, like the Kim dynasty's top ideologist and the founder of Juche-ism, Hwang Chong-yop, who defected to the South Korean embassy in Beijing in 1997. A few days later, Kim Jong-il was reported on Radio Pyongyang as saying, "Cowards, leave if you want to. We will defend the red flag of revolution to the end." Hwang's wife committed suicide. One daughter died in suspicious circumstances, falling off a truck. His other children and grandchildren were reportedly picked up and swept off to the gulag. In North Korea, treachery is punished unto the third generation. Hwang seems to be torn in half between self-hatred because of the consequences of his actions for his family and honor that he had to escape to tell the truth about the regime to stop the lying. It is a hideous dilemma that confronts every single defector. Korea remained isolated from the outside world longer than Timbuktu or Antarctica. In 1806, Mungo Park's fated expedition passed Timbuktu. In 1841, Captain Ross, RN, discovered the Mount Erebus volcano on the edge of the frozen continent. Korea self-enforced removal from modernity was first properly challenged in 1866, when an American gunboat, the USS Sherman, a sidewheeler, chugged up the Tadong River towards Pyongyang. She was ordered to halt by the young king's regent, but the crew plugged on to the city, where after a fracas, she hit a submerged rock and was left vulnerable to Korean fireships. The first two failed, but the third succeeded in setting the Sherman alight, and soon everyone on board perished. This triggered a reaction in Washington, D.C., newly belligerent about defending America's standing in Asia. By the 1880s, the Koreans had been forced to sign a free trade deal with the Americans, and the end of the uber-isolationist dynasty was in sight. But nationalist hopes of a standalone Korea died with the rise and rise of Japan. The Land of the Rising Sun's forces invaded Korea in 1904, sneakily marching north to challenge Russian occupation of Manchuria. The Russians fought and lost, the first significant defeat of a Western-ish power to Asiatic might in modern history. In 1910, the Japanese formally occupied the Korean peninsula, bringing a fascist cherry to top off the Hermit Kingdom's Confucianist obey power cake. In 1945, the Japanese, thanks to the Americans, left Korea for good. In the South, they were replaced by a series of foolish and bloody pro-American dictators who eventually gave way in the 1980s to a proper democracy. In the North, the Japanese governor was replaced by a cutthroat guerrilla boss who had ended up in Stalin's embrace, Kim Il-sung, and the Hermit Kingdom's ideology of total obedience to power, isolation, racial purity, and rigid social stratification is still in place today. We rode into the city along a wide road, the surface comically bumpy, so that we bounced around inside the coach as if we were taking a cross-channel ferry in January. Mr. Hyun and Miss Jun formally introduced themselves with a mixture of jokes and dangers, just like tour guides do in Rome or Paris. But not many tourist guides in the 40-minute transfer between airport and hotel raise the possibility of thermonuclear war between the host country and the United States. Mr. Hyun and Miss Jun were yin and yang, gloom and sun. She seemed to be more open than Mr. Hyun, and certainly more sparky and feisty, and somehow she seemed to be better plugged into the movers and shakers in the DPRK. Miss Jun was always fashionably dressed, and her English was more natural. Mr. Hyun's accent was thicker, and he wore a dark suit, white shirt, black tie, black glasses, suggesting that had he lived in the West, he would have made a natural undertaker. His melancholy bent broke every now and then into a series of infectious giggles, making him oddly likable. Both were excellent ambassadors for their country and never once said anything critical of the regime. They were messengers for a nation out of sync with the rest of the world, and that's not an easy place to be. It would not be quite true to suggest that there was no traffic whatsoever. A few army lorries with canvas roofs, a big black Volga from Soviet times, the odd petrol tanker. Every now and then a hideously overcrowded bus chugged along, also a series of fancy-ish saloons shot by, accommodating the elite. But the ordinary traffic you must struggle through in an ordinary, poor country, the tuk-tuks of Thailand or their equivalents in Bangladesh, the patched-up old bangers that should have died years ago you see on the road in Uganda, it didn't exist. Evidence of absence means something. That the law is, if you are poor, you cannot run a vehicle, still less take it on the grand road from city to airport. My all-time favorite Pyongyang traffic story happened back in 1995 and was told by Alexander Frater of The Observer, who had gone to North Korea as a tourist. One evening, in the Korea bar, Frater was accosted by a middle-aged Danish engineer. "Have you heard the news?" "What news?" "There's been a traffic accident." I stared at him. This was a statistical impossibility. "It's true," he cried. "An Egyptian diplomat ran into a truck." "Is he all right?" "Well, the doctors are still very excited, but yes, I gather the prognosis is good." The bumps could not be ignored. Being tossed and turned as if inside a washing machine suggested that the people who ruled North Korea had a soft spot for the grandiose and a weakness for detail. Why build a motorway if it makes everyone who drives along it seasick? The big road carved through a canyon of multi-story flats. Concrete seemed a popular construction choice, grey a popular colour. After a while, it became apparent that concrete and grey came as standard. Many of the blocks of flats boasted large slogans in red letters, but written in Korean, I couldn't make out their precise meaning. They weren't selling Coca-Cola. We passed an enormous painting of Kim I, smiling girlishly out of a red background. The Korean was later translated for me, "The great leader Kim Il-sung will always be with us." It's an old trope mocked by Shelley in his poem Ozymandias. "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains." Never have I ever seen such monotonous homage to tyranny. On we bounced, past more grey blocks, noting that the ground floor apartments featured heavily barred windows, suggesting that the crime of burglary in the DPRK is not unknown. Past a traffic policewoman in a blue uniform standing in a painted white circle like a witch in some pagan doodah. The traffic witch directed thin air with balletic aplomb. Onwards we went, past the Pyongyang Arc de Triomphe, deliberately a few feet taller than the real thing in Paris, before we came to a stop at our hotel, the Habong San. Above the hotel in Korean, a sign proclaimed, "Hail the light of Korea's military firstism, General Kim Jong-un." It sounds weird and clunky in Korean, too, just like George Orwell's newspeak has a tin ear for lovers of the English language. In late March, the cold in North Korea still bites, with temperatures way below freezing inside the hotel. Those last three words are not a typo. Heat is not something to be wasted if you are not a member of the charmed circle of the Kim dynasty, and the Habong San, in the bottom tier of upmarket tourist establishments in the capital, was not somewhere the ruling class frequented. The Kims were on show, of course, major and minor in black suits looking down at us from an immense painting in the lobby, set against a backdrop of a silly pink dawn, handing out on-the-spot guidance to all and sundry. Above the reception desk proper was a plywood cut-out map of the world, seemingly handcrafted by 5-year-olds. The lobby itself was fronted by large windows, providing a fair chunk of natural light. As we moved to the back to take the lift, the gloom deepened. The lights either did not work or someone had decided not to switch them on. I went for a pee. The men's toilet was dank and dark, much of the floor covered in puddles of wet, cisterns gurgling incontinently. The last time I was in a hotel toilet that squalid was in the Congo, but no one there claimed that it shined a light for the rest of humanity to follow. On the telly there was only one channel to pick. Through a very fuzzy picture we could see Kim Jong-il doing his take on Elvis, giving on-the-spot guidance, or OTSG, to some poor sod somewhere, nowhere, in the sticks. The voiceover was comic, a sub-hysterical woman announcer sobbing and quivering with emotion as she intoned something-something in Korean. You could tell that it wasn't critical. Outside our hotel room, scores of ant-like builders were constructing a building, 24/7, a new joint venture with a Chinese bank, a sign of the economy opening up. Or was it just a new channel for slush money to keep the dynasty in cognac? The construction site wasn't that noisy, because they were pretty much building the place by hand. It crossed my mind, were the hotel rooms bugged? Breen tells story about two Danish engineers working on a project in North Korea and complaining in their hotel room about how boring it all was. "If I'd known, I would have brought a pack of cards with me," one said. The next day at work, their minder presented them with a pack of cards. The creepy bit is that they had been talking in Danish. Downstairs in the hotel bar, plastic toads of implacable creepiness sat immobile in a large, smelly fish tank, empty of water and open at the top. On critical inspection, one jumped, scaring the life out of us. It felt like the first real thing we had seen all day. Chapter 2. Zombie Gods Seep Goo. Breakfast lay in wait in a large, gilt-effect ballroom below zero, entirely empty apart from our party and several jolly Korean waitresses who wafted in, bearing dishes of increasing weirdness. Seahorse brain, hamster droppings on Qatar, and puddles of a sinister jam-like entity jostled for our attention. Okay, I'm making this up, but the cosmic good of bacon and eggs has yet to penetrate the big zombie. Their favourite is kimchi, cabbage steeped in brine. The food wasn't bad, but it was strange. The magnificence of the restaurant was out of kilter with the rest of the hotel, spooky, unlit, freezing-cold corridors. On the stairs, the faint scent that a small creature died in the night. The bedrooms, old-fashioned museum pieces from the 1950s. The doors didn't quite fit the frames, the carpets were rigid and rucked. The lifts clunked and snickered, and every now and then the doors would not open. It was like staying in a mega faulty towers, but with Basil, Sybil, Manuel, Polly and the Major all missing, perhaps gone away for a stay in the mountains. That's North Korean slang for the gulag. The hotel's boastful grand rooms and shoddy everything else left an abiding impression that this was a society that looked great on the architect's plans, but so lacked proper attention to detail as to be almost unfit for habitation. On the steps of the hotel drive, the cold bit deep into our bones. The Korean peninsula is 10 degrees further south than London, but in winter it is very much colder. The British Isles benefit from the wet, warm winds of the Atlantic beating in from the west. Korea suffers from being at the end of the Eurasian continental landmass. It felt Siberian. There were more cars on the roads than expected, with little jamettes of 8 or 9 motors building up here and there for what passed as the Pyongyang rush hour. In town, as on the airport highway, the cars were generally posh-ish Japanese saloons for the elite. The absence of vehicles of the poor, two-stroke rickshaws, scooters, horse and carts, was striking. The vast majority of people moved by bus or on foot. Packs of black-clad workers moved like shoals of fish hither and yon. Every third person seemed to be in army uniform. We were calling on two dead men. On the road to the mausoleum, Mr. Hyun explained that the DPRK would be no walkover. Our people will beat their fists to defend our sovereignty. No one dared get into that double entendre. He went on to explain the do's and don'ts of visiting the dead. The Korean people believe that our president, Kim Il-sung, is always with us. So, when we go to the mausoleum, we don't think we are going to a mausoleum. We are going to meet him. The Kumsusan Palace of the Sun is a cathedral to an alien god and sun. During his lifetime, it was home to Kim Il-sung. In death, it has become his tomb. When Kim Jong-il followed him to the grave, he too ended up there. It's a vast, low, granite, grey-on-grey building, as imposing as a battleship, with concrete patches of greyness where the windows used to be. You enter at basement level along the left side. First up is a Heath Robinson contraption to clean the soles of your shoes. You step on a wet area and then walk forwards onto a living green mat which spins tufts of plastic greenery against your soles. It's like having your feet tickled by robot ferns. No mud enters the palace. You dump your bags, wallets, cameras, anything that could record the dead, in vast cloakrooms, efficiently run, and you are then commanded to square up in lines of four. The robotization of your mind begins. Step out of line, someone hisses at you. Pretty quickly, you yourself end up helping to enforce the system that encoils you. A very small and simple addition of the mental enslavement that the regime practices against its 23 million people. We are transported along what feels like the longest travelator on the planet. There is a second security sweep at the end, just to make sure that you're not being a naughty boy and have smuggled in a hidden camera. We hadn't. The first thing you see when you enter the palace proper is an enormous marble statue of Kim Il-sung, belly gently swelling under a business suit in a display of bourgeois amplitude. "Look at me, I'm fat," says the stone god. Kim in marble is attended by mega vases flowing with flowers and guarded by dead-eyed soldiers of abstract mathematical beauty. You are firmly guided through a series of chambers, well-lit and pleasantly air-conditioned, decorated with photographs and paintings of Kim the First meeting Tyrants R. Us, Stalin, Mao, Gaddafi, Ceausescu, Erich Honecker of East Germany, Gustav Husak of former Czechoslovakia, Wojciech Jaruzelski of Poland, Todor Zhivkov of Bulgaria, Janusz Kadar of Hungary. Of that crowd, only Jaruzelski, perhaps the least bad or certainly the most tormented of the old school of dictators, is still alive. There's a sameness about all the poses, all empty smiles and smooth bottoms, while the weeping of the tyrant's victims takes place, unheard, elsewhere. Oh look, there's Kim Won with Teoduro Obiang, the president of Equatorial Guinea, who reportedly likes eating his critics' testicles in a white wine sauce with heart-shaped croutons. Plus some nabobs you've never heard of. Step forward, Mokhtar Ould Dada of Mauritania. I looked him up. He was a tyrant too. Next, you walk through a sinister grey machine, black rubber nozzles on its side, blowing great gusts of air at you. It's hard to see what good this machine can do, apart from making the point that you are somehow unclean. It's decorated with antiquated 1960s dials with arrows aflicker. I looked around for a one-eyed Donald Pleasance in a Mao suit stroking a large white pussy, but it must have been his day off. The Chamber of Death is so backlit with an early morning bright pink, it is like walking around inside an enormous pig's bladder. This is perhaps not quite the effect that is intended. The old dictator lies in a large glass box, a prize beetle. A blanket shrouds much of his body. His neck, once deformed by the enormous goiter, is perfect. So is the blackness of his artificial hair. The goiter should have been powerful evidence of the imperfect nature of humanity. Instead, it did not exist, airbrushed out of official portraits and sculptures. The writer Michael Breen met Kim Il-sung in 1994. One notable personal feature of Kim Il-sung was the massive grenade-sized goiter on the back of his neck. When we had the pre-lunch interview session with Kim, a guard stood on the offending side to block the photographers. I wondered whether the security folk planned this deployment using a code name for it. Breen, answering his own question, called it The Thing. The first reference I can find to The Thing is in 1980, when Tiziano Terzani was smuggled into Pyongyang on the back of an Italian Communist Party delegation led by Enrico Berlinguer. In a chapter on North Korea entitled Red Flag, Blue Blood, Terzani wrote, "The cyst on the back of his neck is bigger than a fist, but it does not seem to hinder his movements. For years, the cyst has continued to grow, but no one has dared operate. Although it seems unlikely that it is a malignant tumor, the cyst is now at the center of endless rumors and speculation." Professor Myers believes that North Korea's veiled ideology of racial perfection made keeping the thing secret a necessity of state. He told me, "Whenever you have a race theory, whenever you have an ideology that asserts that the purity of the race is important, you're naturally going to have an even greater aversion to physical defects and birth defects than you would have in countries without such an ideology. This is one of the reasons why the North Korean regime was so averse to showing the growth on Kim Il-sung's neck. He could only be photographed or filmed from a certain angle so that he would look to be in perfect health to the North Korean people. Why couldn't he get rid of it? Apparently it was too big to be removed," said Myers. Nikolai Ceausescu's translator, Isidore Urian, of whom more later, met Kim Il-sung at least 50 times and got to know the thing well. "It was an accumulation of fat," the former Romanian diplomat told me. "Nothing more than that." This may not be medically correct. Goiters are normally associated with a benign tumor of the thyroid gland. "How big?" He motioned to a bowl of peanuts on the table between us, bigger than my clenched fist. "There was no official ban on photographs, but if a photograph was taken, then it would go to the censors, so the photographers would avoid it. He was favored on the other side of his neck." And then, confidentially, Isidore leaned towards me. He was very afraid of doctors. The thing is no more, but the corpse is still with us. In his glass box, Kim's face oozes a waxiness that is monstrous. But you can't take much of this in before your robot four shuffles towards the holy mummy, and then you bow. You shuffle to the next side, bow again, shuffle to his head, where weirdly you don't bow, and then to the fourth side for one last bow, and you're out. Let there be no doubt. North Korea is seized by a political religion. The next chamber boasts a Bond villain map of the world with snail trails of bleeping lights where Kim Il-sung went choo-choo-choo-choo on his royal train, mostly through China to Moscow and back. The royal train carriage sits sweetly on oiled wheels, going nowhere in a hurry. It may have seemed immensely luxurious in 1953. In the 21st century, though, it looks train-spottily naff. By the royal train is a royal Mercedes of roughly the same era, its radiator grille snarling, Al Capone's teeth set in chrome. Next up is the chamber housing the glass box of God the Sun, Kim Jong-il. It is the same stately gavotte around a corpse as performed for God the Father. Kim, too, in death, looks no less weird than when he was alive. Why bow and scrape for a bad Elvis impersonator? Still, the robot conditioning kicks in, and I bow 3 times. How do you embalm a stiff? First, gut your corpse, extracting the offal heart, lungs, and fiddly bits. You go in through the back, leaving the front of the body as intact as possible. You never know when the dear dictator's loved ones or secret policemen want to pop by for one last kiss. Suck the blood out, pump in the goo. It's a witch's brew of formaldehyde, acetous potassium, sodium chloride, glycerin, and ethanol. The Russians are the masters of this sacred art, the Chinese less so. They pumped poor Mao so full of formaldehyde he swelled up like a gigantic balloon, and then the tyrant went pop, oozing fluid from every pore. Oh dear. You need to control the temperature and the humidity, hence the glass boxes. Too hot and the corpse rots, too cold and it freezes, then develops a kind of necrotic frostbite and goes an unpleasant shade of green. Over about 6 months, the formaldehyde replaces the water in the stiff. The goo glues muscle tissue, producing that telltale fixity of flesh in an embalmed body. It's a whole-body Botox treatment. The Russian boffins who keep Lenin in the pink, on permanent display in Red Square since 1924, are rumoured to freshen him up twice a week. The goo itself starts to go funny after a year and a half, so it has to be replaced, just like you would the engine oil in your car. The goo leaks into the suits the stiffs wear, so they have to be changed every now and then, too. Lenin has a special pump in his chest, they say, to keep the goo at just the right viscosity, more treacly than treacle. The two Soviet heroes who first kept Lenin pickled, Boris Zabarsky and Vladimir Vorobyev, both came to a sticky end. Vorobyev died in hospital under mysterious circumstances in 1937, the year of Stalin's Great Terror. Zabarsky was arrested by Stalin's goons in 1952, released a year later, but soon died of a stroke. Zabarsky's son, Ilya, took over the family pickle factory and ran Lenin's mausoleum until 1989 when he retired. After Ilya, the new old man on the block was Sergei Diebev, interviewed by Andrew Higgins of The Independent in 1993 at the age of 73. Diebev described pickling Stalin, no easy task in 1953. They sent a car to collect me when he died and took me to the laboratory. My hands were shaking. He was dead, but his bodyguards still stood there watching everything we did to him. Diebev and his colleagues did a good job on Stalin, embalming him for all eternity. Then Khrushchev read out the secret speech about Stalin being a mass murderer, and a few years on Stalin was removed and buried in the Kremlin wall. Diebev was particularly proud of his work on Ho Chi Minh. They did the job in 1969 inside a mountain, avoiding American bombs. 2 transport planes flew in from Russia with air conditioners and other equipment to preserve the corpse. It was all very difficult. The war was on and there was nothing. Even distilled water had to be brought in from Moscow. Uncle Ho, the waxwork, still hangs out in his own mausoleum in Vietnam. Uniting all 6 pickled great ones, Lenin, Ho Chi Minh, Mao, Ferdinand Marcos, Kim Il-sung, and Kim Jong-il, is a Sikh religiosity that seeks, pharaoh-like, to continue life after death. The waxen sheen they all exude is proof of how fatuous that dream is. The chambers leading away from Kim Jong-il's waxwork boasted similar artifacts to those in the chamber after his dad, a royal train carriage complete with desk and on it an Apple MacBook Pro. Whatever effect seeing the Apple might have on ordinary North Koreans, to us it smacked of repugnant hypocrisy. Only Kim II was allowed to use the internet. What did Kim II watch online? An intoxicating mixture of hardcore porn, some say, and something entirely different. One story goes that the people who ran Lady Thatcher's website noted that they had a regular follower from one IP address in North Korea. Who could it have been other than Kim Jong-il? Gifts of obeisance from various entirely predictable banana republics were offered for our inspection, but also there was a plaque of some kind from Derbyshire County Council sent in the late 1980s, when the prospect of world revolution made Derby blush and Chesterfield's spire tilt yet more crookedly off-centre. On the way out, two women wept openly. Was it just for show? Or, somehow harder to bear, did they really mean it? The devotion of the people to the state seems absolute. How can a nation be so enthralled to a regime that has led to the wholly unnecessary deaths of millions of its own people? Perhaps it is because they have been told a powerful fairy tale all their lives. The fresh air seemed a gift. But even outside the House of the Zombie Gods, their baleful influence did not lose its hold over our minds. It was fine for us to walk in the grounds in front of the Great Palace, but a dozen or so workers rested on their haunches, hand-fixing paving slabs that were being repositioned and tidying up garden beds. We sensed by now that trying to photograph or film this scene of human imperfection would be unwelcome, would somehow break the power of the precious illusion. This is a land where just trying to capture the small change moments of life places you in political conflict with the regime. Best not to bother. And then, yet again, the regime wins. We got back on the bus, crossed town, and ended up at the Juche Tower, a great concrete prick jabbing at the sky, purposefully 1 meter taller than the Washington Monument, there to honour one of the regime's proclaimed ideologies, Jucheism. The view from the top was striking, but not quite in the way the regime would have liked. Ahead was the Tadong River, a bit wider than the Thames at Greenwich, which flows through Pyongyang. Beyond that, Kim Il-sung Square and the main party and regime buildings. But immediately behind was the East Bank, grim, grey blocks of flats, all copies of the same East German architect's design, and single bungalows, poor, mean, miserable. To be fair, the air was clean. This was the first Third World capital I've been to with no smog. The North Koreans have solved the problem of pollution. There is no industry. If anyone is tempted to get all soppy about North Korea's green credentials, bear in mind the testimony of one defector who worked at a uranium processing factory. The trees next to the river died, and so did all the fish. The workers' hair fell out. Blood used to seep out of the defector's mouth. Health and safety does not exist in North Korea. On then to an enormous plaza to inspect a vast, concrete, three-pronged obelisk in the centre of Pyongyang, boasting a hammer, a sickle, and a lithographer's brush etched against the sky. Hammer, sickle, and brush are the symbols of workers in the factory, the fields, and, by brain, the totems of the Korean Workers' Party. The words in concrete sang out, "Hail the Korean Workers' Party! All the Korean people's unifier and leader." No one sang back. Apart from our guides, no North Korean was present. Remember, in North Korea, nothing is as it seems. The proclaimed ideology of the nation is not the real one. The national Stalinism represented by the three prongs is fake. So too is Jucheism, neatly skewered by one authority as a stodgy jumble of banalities. Jucheism and Kim Il-sungism both serve the personality cult by pretending that Kim I was a great thinker, he was no such thing, but they are cosmic stick-ons, like beauty spots or fake eyelashes. The real ideology of the DPRK is racial purity. That's perhaps why the regime has lasted so long, because what it believes in fits snugly with something in the North Korean psyche. To be fair, in a society so closed off from the outside world that few people know the Americans have walked on the surface of the moon, The chance of them realizing they have been told a big lie is slim. In the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Mario Vargas Llosa's warning, "Ideology is fiction that doesn't realize it's fiction," will never be given airtime. The North Korean credo is a paranoid, racially pure, Nazi-esque ideology. It has much in common with fascist thought. That is the considered judgment of Professor Myers, who studied first the ideology of communist East Germany and now spends his time soaking up the belief system of the DPRK. For example, Myers cites a hugely popular novella of the 1950s in which two American missionaries and their son kill a Korean child by injecting germs into the blood. The old jackal's spade-shaped eagle nose hung villainously over his upper lip, while the vixen's teats jutted out like the stomach of a snake that has just swallowed a demon, and the slippery wolf cub gleamed with poison like the head of a venomous snake has just swallowed its skin. Their six sunken eyes seemed like open graves, constantly waiting for corpses. This stuff could have been lifted from the pages of Julius Streicher's Der Strümer. When the North and the South met at the DMZ in 2006, the media were present to hear the small talk between two generals before the meeting proper started in private. The soldier from the South spoke about how quite a few farmers from his half were marrying foreigners. When the general from the North scowled at this, the southerner downplayed his remark, saying that such marriages were a mere drop of ink in the Han River, the South Korean equivalent of the Thames, at which the general from the north spat out, "Not even one drop of ink must be allowed." Britain's former ambassador to North Korea, John Everard, questions comparisons to Stalinism in his book Only Beautiful Please, arguing the regime's mainstay is xenophobic nationalism rather than socialism. The closest Western analogue to the DPRK is probably Nazi Germany. Pyongyang watcher Aidan Foster Carter draws similar conclusions. Read North Korean propaganda in German, and the emphasis on Der Führer and the triumph of the will suggest a very different, or is it totalitarian, comparison. Christopher Hitchens, once vilified by George Galloway MP as a drink-sodden former Trotskyist popinjay, nothing much wrong with any of that, and the best writer of English prose since Orwell, observed of North Korea, "I saw exactly one picture of Marx and one of Lenin in my whole stay, but it's been a long time since ideology has anything to do with it. Not without cunning, fat man, Kim Il-sung, and little boy, Kim Jong-il, gradually mutated the whole state belief system into a debased form of Confucianism in which traditional ancestor worship and respect for order became blended with extreme nationalism and xenophobia." The question that troubles many Pyongyangologists is, how has North Korea survived long after, say, the state that Stalin built was dead? The answer, perhaps, is that North Korea has outlived the Soviet Union because it was never truly communist in the first place, but owes its stability to its roots in Korean feudalism and racism. Also, Stalinism was itself not just about command economy and the personality cult, but borrowed heavily from Russian traditionalism and xenophobia, so the Kimist jump from there to racism is not that big a leap. Kimism, by the way, is a term used by the Pyongyangologist Adrian Buzo as an umbrella description of the regime's ideology in his sharply written book, The Guerrilla Dynasty, which he identifies as a blend of national Stalinism, xenophobia, ultra-traditionalism, and criminality. Kimism was forged, says Buzo, when Kim Il-sung was a freedom fighter come robber baron in Manchuria in the few years up to 1940, when he escaped into Stalin's Soviet Union. Buzo's insights do not conflict with Myers's judgment that the regime's ideology is far right, They effectively support it. But why Juche-ism, with its talk of self-reliance? Why still bother with the pseudo-Marxism of the Korean Workers' Party, three prongs and all? Perhaps it's a clever trick, a decoy. There are many people in the Western world who will give an anti-capitalist regime the benefit of the doubt. Hardly anyone who will stand up for a nakedly racist state. So North Korea faces both ways, putting out the old Workers' Party rhetoric for external consumption while telling its own people a different story of us against the foreigners. All racism is ugly, but there is something particularly abhorrent about racism even a child can sense, about a lisping tot doing elementary addition and subtraction by counting American corpses, the reason why, Breen reports, one foreign diplomat took her child out of a North Korean nursery. On the third prong, the intellectual's brush, in Western culture, it would of course be a pen, Myers observes that the brush has helped keep casual foreign observers from recognizing the DPRK's intense anti-intellectualism. Western fears of minds being dumbed down by idiot TV and computer games are as naught compared with what happens in North Korea. If you belong to a nation where, as a child, you are taught lies about history at school, you are taught to spout banalities at university, where you cannot speak your mind, it's going to make it virtually impossible to frame the thought, is our system as good as they say it is? So the Korean Workers' Party's three prongs is a big lie in concrete, while the real belief of the system is Nazi-esque racial purity with bolted-on bits of Japanese fascism and Stalinist mind control. None of this, of course, was mentioned by or discussed with our minders. Our party was 13 strong, including 9 LSE students from all corners of the world, 2 Russians, 2 Swiss, a German, a Moroccan, an African-American, an Australian, and 1 Briton, and 1 alumnus, He Yong, an unflappable Singaporean. In North Korea, the students were great company, politely cynical about the regime's nonsense, thoughtful, good fun. 2 of the 3 BBC team had also been to LSE, my wife Tomiko, and, going all the way back to 1977 to 1980, me. Tomiko, the name is Japanese but she is British to the core, had been to North Korea with the LSE's Student Unions International Relations Club, which she ran, the year before. The odd man out was Alex Niarchuris, an alumnus of the University of Wales, half Greek, half Welsh, an odd combination, but then he is an odd man in many ways. He was also our shooter-producer, his fiendishly difficult job to film everything that moved without appearing to do so. He did so with great good humour. Throughout our trip, a North Korean cameraman from the Korean International Travel Company followed us everywhere. He filmed us. He didn't know it, but we filmed him. He filmed us, filming him, filming us. Once Alex, being mischievous, said to me, po-faced, "You know this place is so fascinating, it would be great to make a documentary here." I replied, quick as a flash, "We are, Alex, we are," forgetting that this was our ultra-code yellow secret. Alex used a Canon 5D camera, readily available in the high street. It looks like a hefty stills camera, but it can shoot broadcast-quality, high-definition video. Alex's problem was that he didn't want to look like a professional cameraman, with the 5D pressed against his eye all the time, so he nursed it at chest height, unable to check the image. The result was mental torture for Alex, wobble vision for much of the time, but it worked. Sound was a much bigger headache. The microphone in the 5D is so-so, and normally we would have used radio mics. Vetoing that as too risky, we busked it, hoping that we would be able to capture moments here and there. Tomiko had another stills and video camera, much smaller, and mine was the least fancy of the lot, as big as a packet of fags. We took in loads of electronic cards, but no laptops, and hoped that they would not twig our game. There being no internet or shops selling electronic stuff in North Korea, how would the cameraman know that we were filming him, filming us? At the end of the trip, we paid 40 euros a head for the KITC video, complete with uplifting voiceover from an excitable, no, preposterously melodramatic Korean lady. On the three prongs in concrete, she proclaimed, "This monument was erected in October 1995 to mark the founding of the Workers' Party of Korea." The party, according to the North Koreans, can trace its origin back to the Down with Imperialism Union, founded in October 1926 by Kim Il-sung, then just 14 years old. This is, of course, rubbish. The back history was invented years later to make Kim look good. When he was 14, he was still playing the church organ. The obelisk was empty of people, of life, of movement. And that is odd. Go to Trafalgar Square in London. You may care to salute the one-eyed pirate atop his column or not, but you will be accosted by people selling you something, maybe a life choice or a DVD of I, Robot in Russian, or all the Mongolian food you can eat for a tenner. The same goes for any big public space in DC or New York or Paris or Berlin, or even these days Beijing, though not Tiananmen Square, just in case anyone starts getting funny ideas about Chinese democracy. What was odd was that no one pounced on the evidently prosperous foreigners in the vast empty space by the KWP obelisk in Pyongyang. Clearly, there was an order not to make contact. It was the same in Ceausescu's Romania in 1985. Not a single ordinary Romanian came up to our group of journalists. Only in 1989, when I spent Christmas with the Ceausescus, as it were, did I begin to appreciate the power and terror generated by the secret police, the Securitate, before the revolution. There was an order for any person who made contact with a foreigner to report it to the police within 24 hours. The police would then pass on the file to the Securitate. As a consequence, foreigners were shunned. An order very much like the Romanian one must be in place in North Korea, and it is absolutely obeyed. In 8 days in North Korea, not a single ordinary individual started a conversation with us. Our minders did not mention the regime's secret police, but they do exist. The security department, in Korean, Bowibu, is the power in the land. The world expert on the Bowibu is a former U.S. intelligence analyst, Ken E. Gorse. He reports that the Bowibu employ around 50,000 people, are based in the Amisan area of Pyongyang, there are satellite pictures, and were effectively led by Kim Jong-il from the late 1980s to his death in 2011. The Bowibu are officially known as the Korean People's Army Unit, 10215, which just so happened to host Kim Jong-un's second public on-site inspection since he became heir apparent in September 2010. The Bowibu spy on everyone worth spying on, the palace's most loyal retainers, officials in the government and the party, generals in the army, the dynasty's trickier relatives, the police, ordinary people, and, of course, foreigners. Did the Bowibu spy on us? Were our minders Bowibu or reporting to them? The answer, according to Greg Scarlatoe, executive director of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea and the publisher of Gorse's report, is yes, of course. They spy on ordinary people through an entity called the Inmin-ban, which roughly translates as Neighborhood Watch. In every single city district, town and village in the north, the local watch committee consists of between 20 and 40 households, roughly around 100 people, including children, led by busybody snoopers who know they might get some advantage by reporting a neighbor listening to South Korean pop songs or flashing around more money than they ought to have. The Inmin-bans are responsible for keeping the streets clean, polishing statues and portraits of Kims 1 and 2, and making sure people attend the regime's self-criticism meetings. They combine being neighborhood snoopers with the eyes and ears at street level of the secret police. Leaving the concrete colossus behind, we set off for lunch, a hot pot restaurant where you cook your own meat on a kerosene stove placed on the table. The results were okay-ish, either a bit too chewy or a bit overdone. Everywhere we ate, one got the impression that the quality and quantity of food was spectacular by North Korean standards, but pretty depressing for anyone used to eating, say, street food in China, or KFC in Des Moines, or fish and chips in Liverpool. Back on the tourist bus, with one exit and one microphone in Mr. Hume's hands, it was proving a brilliant totalitarian tool. We headed southwest from the capital towards the Yellow Sea. We visited the Kangso Mineral Water Plant, above it the proclamation, "Hail the light of Korea's military firstism, General Kim Jong-un." It's possible that this was a brand new slogan, or that they only had to change the last two characters to accommodate the change from Kim Jong-il to Kim Jong-un. Outside, three bears glugged water. They were, of course, fake. Water from a hot spring gurgled into a thick glass dead end. There was a handsome Italian-made production line, full of brilliantly polished stainless steel vats, but no sign of production at any time in the recent past. We were offered bottles of water to taste. It had the bouquet of sulphurous muck. Being a natural diplomat, I proclaimed, "Ah, the champagne of water!" which Mr. Hune found so funny he spat his out and bent double, giggling. If you bottle mineral water, you should have a yard full of stacked pallets with empty bottles to be processed and packed bottles ready to be shipped off to your customers. Of that, there was no sign. The story behind the bottling plant with no bottles starts well, with an exciting joint venture between the two Koreas, and pretty much stops with two hammer blows, the killing of a tourist and a nuclear test. In 2011, the Hankorae newspaper told the melancholy tale of South Korean investor Lee Da-sik. The sunshine or engagement policy of left-of-center governments in Seoul had encouraged him to start up a trading business with the North. The sunshine policy sounds nice, but critics accuse the South and the Clinton administration of being overly credulous towards an entirely dishonest dictatorship. They satirize the sunshine policy as the moonshine policy. To begin with, Lee imported Pyongyang rice vodka, soju, and sought after agricultural